You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Krista Smith writes this Vanity Fair spotlight. Change Agent. Photograph by Sebastian Kim. Priyanka Chopra, photographed at the London, New York City Hotel in Manhattan. If America's real-life political drama feels short on hope and a hero, we now have Priyanka Chopra. The dynamic actress stars on ABC's hit thriller Quantico as FBI agent Alex Parrish, perpetually gone rogue for the sake of humanity. She's a tough girl living in a man's world, says Chopra of her character, and she's a leader in that man's world. The same could be said of Chopra, who broke barriers as the first South Asian woman to lead a prime-time network show in the U.S., but she was already a phenomenon in her native India. Chopra was crowned Miss World 2000 when she was 18, which she followed up with more than 50 films in Hindi, while steadily steering her talents toward Hollywood and an English-language music career that includes collaborations with Pitbull and Pharrell. The hardest part of starting work in America, after having an almost 15-year career elsewhere, says Chopra, was to have to walk into a room and introduce myself. This month, Quantico returns for its third season, Terrorist and Traitors Beware, and Chopra is boosting her profile stateside with two feature films on the horizon, Isn't It Romantic, a rom-com with Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth, in which Chopra plays a bratty yogi and a kid like Jake, opposite Claire Danes and Octavia Spencer, about a gender non-conforming four-year-old. Of the latter, Chopra says, I had to be a part of this. It's such a relevant conversation right now. In addition to serving as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, she founded the Priyanka Chopra Foundation for Health and Education, an effort to give girls access to higher education. She shares humanitarian interest with her friend Meghan Markle, so it may not be a surprise to see Chopra among the royal wedding guests come May. She has never stopped traveling and keeps homes in New York, where she shoots Quantico, and in Mumbai, where she has a production company, Purple Pebble Pictures. I go where my work takes me, says Chopra. When you want something bad enough, you find a way of doing it. And I want the world.
Thank you.
the last words on the bridge. A recording salvaged from 3 miles deep tells the story of the doomed El Faro, a cargo ship engulfed by a hurricane, by William Languisha. Opening photo illustration by Yuko Shimizu. No survivors. The search lasted for 7 days and covered more than 180,000 square miles of ocean. And in this very stylized, Asian-looking illustration we see the El Faro keeling over, containers splashing into the roiling ocean. 1. The clock is ticking. In the darkness before dawn on Thursday, October 1st, 2015, an American merchant captain named Michael Davidson sailed a 790-foot U.S.-flagged cargo ship, El Faro, into the eye wall of a Category 3 hurricane on the exposed windward side of the Bahama Islands. El Faro means the lighthouse in Spanish. The hurricane, named Joaquin, was one of the heaviest ever to hit the Bahamas. It overwhelmed and sank the ship. Davidson and the 32 others aboard drowned. They had been headed from Jacksonville, Florida, on a weekly run to San Juan, Puerto Rico, carrying 391 containers and 294 trailers and cars. The ship was 430 miles southeast of Miami, in deep water, when it went down. Davidson was 53 and known as a stickler for safety. He came from Windham, Maine, and left behind a wife and 2 college-age daughters. Neither his remains nor those of his shipmates were ever recovered. Disasters at sea do not get the public attention that aviation accidents do, in part because the sea swallows the evidence. It has been reported that a major merchant ship goes down somewhere in the world every 2 or 3 days. Most are ships sailing under flags of convenience, with underpaid crews and poor safety records. The El Faro tragedy attracted immediate attention for several reasons. El Faro was a U.S.-flagged ship with a respected captain, and it should have been able to avoid the hurricane. Why didn't it? Add to that mystery this simple fact. The sinking of El Faro was the worst U.S. maritime disaster in 3 decades. To the outside world, the first hint of trouble came with a phone call that Captain Davidson made from El Faro's navigation bridge to the owners, a shipping company called Tote, and specifically to the safety and operations manager, a former captain named John Lawrence, who was listed on the ship as the official point of contact or designated person ashore. The time was 6:59 a.m., just after dawn. Lawrence was dressing for work at his home in Jacksonville, and he just missed answering. When he got to his cell phone, he saw that the call had come in from a satellite number and that a voicemail had been left. He listened to the message, which sounded calm, even nonchalant. It was 33 seconds long. "Captain Lawrence, Captain Davidson, Thursday morning, 0700. We have a navigational incident. I'll keep it short. A scuttle popped open on 2-deck, and we were having some free communication of water go down the 3-hold. Have a pretty good list. I want to just contact you verbally here. Everybody's safe, but I want to talk to you." There was no background noise. To Lawrence, this did not sound like a message of distress. He began to dial the satellite number to return the call. Meanwhile, Davidson, having failed to get through, dialed Tote's emergency call center, a company that provides after-hours services primarily to physicians. At 7:01, the operator answered. Sounding less casual than he had in his message to Lawrence, Davidson said, "This is a marine emergency." "Yes, this is a marine emergency." The operator said, "Okay, sir." "Are you connecting me through to a QI?" QI stands for Qualified Individual. He used the term to mean a designated person ashore. The operator answered, "That's what I'm getting ready to do. We are seeing who is on call, and I'm going to get you right to them. Give me 1 second, sir. I'm going to put you on a quick hold. So, 1 moment, please." She paused. "Okay, sir, I just need your name, please." "Yes, ma'am, my name is Michael Davidson. Michael C. Davidson." She paused. "Your rank?" "Ship's master." "Okay, thank you." She paused. "Ship's name?" "El Faro." "Spell that. E-L." Davidson said, "Oh man, the clock is ticking. Can I please speak to a QI?" His voice crackled with tension. "El Faro! Echo, Lima, Space, Foxtrot, Alpha, Romeo, Oscar, El Faro." "Okay, in case I lose you, what is your phone number, please?" He gave her 2 numbers. She said, "Got it, sir. Again, I'm going to get you reached right now. 1 moment, please." While he waited, Davidson used a handheld radio to call the ship's chief mate, who was on a lower deck checking on a cargo hold that was flooding massively. Another operator at the call center came on the line. She said, "Just really briefly, what is the problem you're having?" Her request appears to have been a procedural requirement at the call center. Davidson had already been waiting for 5 minutes, and at one point had impatiently muttered, "Oh, God." Now he answered in a resigned monotone, "I have a marine emergency, and I would like to speak to a QI. We had a hull breach. A scuttle blew open during a storm. We have water down in 3 hold with a heavy list. We've lost the main propulsion unit. The engineers cannot get it going. Can I speak to a QI, please?" The operator said, "Yes, thank you so much." She paused. "One moment." She patched him through to Lawrence. On the phone at last with his peer, Davidson sounded calm again. He said, "Yeah, I'm real good. We have secured the source of water coming into the vessel. A scuttle was blown open by the water, perhaps. No one knows, can't tell. It's since been closed. However, 3 holds got a considerable amount of water in it. We have a very, very healthy port list. The engineers cannot get lube oil pressure on the plant, therefore we've got no main engine. And let me give you a latitude and longitude. I just wanted to give you a heads up before I push that button." Next illustration, collision course. The captain of El Faro, heading southeast, thought his ship could avoid Hurricane Joaquin, heading southwest. And in this chart, you can see the course from Jacksonville, Florida, to Puerto Rico, the charted course, the intended course. And you can see Hurricane Joaquin dead ahead in the course. Lawrence was in his kitchen, scribbling notes. He was surprised at the mention of the button, an electronic distress signal, because the ship's predicament, though concerning, did not sound so dire initially. Lawrence knew about a hurricane brewing somewhere off the Bahamas, but it did not cross his mind that Davidson might have sailed right into it. Davidson said, "The swell is out of the northeast, a solid 10 to 12 feet. Spray, high winds, very poor visibility. That's the best I can give you right now." He did not know the wind speeds because the ship's anemometer was in disrepair and had been for weeks. It is now believed that the winds were sustained at 115 miles per hour with higher gust. As for the waves, Davidson appears to have underreported them, perhaps as a matter of professional style. El Faro was, in fact, struggling to endure steep, breaking waves 30 to 40 feet high and was occasionally encountering waves still higher. These monsters were smashing over the ship, knocking containers overboard, and boiling across a lower second deck that by design was watertight below but open to the sea. That second deck was the location of the scuttle that had been opened. Threehold was a cavernous two-deck space below it, just aft of midship. Lawrence asked for a measure of the list. Davidson said, "Betcha it's all of 15 degrees. 15 degrees is steep. Lawrence said he would inform the Coast Guard. Davidson said, "Yup, what I wanted to do. I want to push that button." Lawrence thought he should get out of the way by getting off the phone. He said, "You do your thing, Captain." Davidson said, "Okay. I just wanted to give you that courtesy so you wouldn't be blindsided by it and have the opportunity. Everybody's safe right now. We're in survival mode now." Two, beyond reach. Those were the last words heard from El Faro. 1 minute after the phone call ended, the ship sent out a distress alert by satellite. 30 seconds later, El Faro sent the Coast Guard a security alert message, a signal that contained the ship's coordinates, as well as drift, speed, and direction. The ship also sent a similar message to Tote, which arrived by email on Lawrence's phone. Next photos, anatomy of a disaster. A portion of the wreckage of El Faro, located a month after the sinking. The ship, pre-hurricane and without its cargo, in Baltimore. And the ship's recovered data recorder on its way to the National Transportation Safety Board. At 7:38 a.m., a Coast Guard petty officer in Miami rang Lawrence in his Jacksonville kitchen. After some preliminaries, he said, "Okay, do you have contact or direct communication with the vessel?" Lawrence said, "I did. They called me. I was just actually trying to call them back, and I couldn't. The satellite is dropping the call. I can give you the phone number." He gave him the number, though it did not matter. It is now known that sometime in the 39 minutes since Davidson left his message, El Faro had already sunk, and its crew was in the water beyond reach of rescue, at the center of an impenetrable storm. By mid-morning, people began to fear the worst. Having checked the latest dispatches from the National Hurricane Center, the Miami Rescue Coordination Center went into full-blown emergency action. It asked that Air Force Reserve hurricane hunters divert from their meteorological mission and look for the ship. Conditions in flight were so rough that the pilots were unable to descend below 10,000 feet. By the third day, the storm had reversed course, as meteorologists had anticipated it eventually would, and was moving to the northeast, clobbering islands as it went, but leaving room in its wake for a massive search to begin. 7 military aircraft covered 30,581 square miles of ocean that day and found 2 debris fields, including 3 life rings, one of which bore the stenciled name El Faro. On the fourth and fifth days, searchers found two empty life rafts and El Faro's starboard lifeboat, which was floating vertically with only its bow above the surface. When it was recovered, it was found to have been mortally damaged, crushed on both the left and right sides. After an orange immersion suit was spotted in the water, a Coast Guard helicopter lowered a rescue swimmer down to investigate. The swimmer found human remains inside, in such an advanced state of decomposition that he couldn't identify the gender. Before the body could be recovered, the helicopter was called off to investigate a report of a second immersion suit with a possible survivor. The crew was unable to find it, and when they returned for the corpse, they could not relocate it because a marker beacon they had left behind had failed. On the morning of the fifth day, the Coast Guard announced officially what was already known. It was likely that El Faro had sunk. The search for survivors continued for another 2 days, ultimately covering more than 180,000 square miles, and turned up a couple of oil slicks, 3 empty immersion suits, 3 more life rings, and a 20-mile stretch of floating dolls from a container that had burst open. Even before the search for survivors ended, 2 separate but collaborative investigations got underway, one by the Coast Guard and the other by the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, a small federal agency with no regulatory powers, but authority that stems from its independence and prowess. How could a catastrophe like this have happened? El Faro was 41 years old when it died, well past normal retirement age, but it was not a decrepit rust bucket. In port, it was regularly visited by the American Bureau of Shipping, a private classification society whose services were engaged and paid for by the ship's owners, and to which the Coast Guard, for want of manpower and expertise, has partially delegated inspection authority. The ship's paperwork was in order. Admittedly, El Faro had sailed into an intense hurricane that no ship, no matter how seaworthy, should have tangled with, a move that would have to be explained. It was unlikely that there would be a single cause or culprit, because there rarely is. Most significant aviation and shipping disasters, as well as industrial catastrophes, are eventually determined to be system accidents, the result of a cascade of small errors, failures, and coincidences. Absent any one of them, and the disaster would not have occurred, a truth that is not knowable in real time, only in retrospect. Much could be discovered through the Coast Guard's public hearings and analysis of the reams of documentation that pertain to any U.S. flagged ship. It was also essential to go out and find the wreck, survey it, and bring up the ship's digital voyage data recorder. That task was arduous, but the ship was found resting upright on a sandy plain 15,400 feet beneath the surface, and the recorder, a circuit board barely 2.5 inches long, was eventually retrieved. It contained the final 26 hours of conversations among 9 doomed people on the bridge. The audio quality was poor, but a technical team was able to extract most of the spoken words and produce a 496-page transcript, by far the longest in the NTSB's history. The transcript is a remarkable document, an unadorned record of nothing more than the sounds on the bridge. The people involved are identified in the transcript only by their shipboard ranks, but the names of the officers are part of the public record, and in the time since the tragedy, other names have been revealed. It is now possible to know with reasonable certainty what occurred. 3. A safety first man. The story begins with the captain, Michael Davidson. He grew up near the waterfront in Portland, Maine, and at age 16 got his first maritime job on a local harbor ferry. He graduated from the Maine Maritime Academy, a state college overlooking the port of Castine on Penobscot Bay, in 1988. He then began sailing on oil tankers between Alaska and West Coast ports. He stuck with the Alaskan route for the next 15 years, rising from third mate to the rank of chief mate. The Gulf of Alaska is notoriously rough, and Davidson sailed through countless storms, some of hurricane strength. He was by no means a cowboy. He was a by-the-book mariner with a reputation for being unusually competent and organized. By training and temperament, he was a safety-first man. Eventually, he switched to dry cargo ships on the East Coast and went to work for one of the big American shipping companies, Crowley Maritime. He was a man at peace with himself. But then, in 2012, an incident rocked his career. Crowley Maritime asked him to take his ship down the Chesapeake from one port to another, and Davidson refused because a surveyor had found that the steering gear was unreliable and in need of immediate repair. For the sake of the ship, Davidson instead engaged two tugs to tow it to the destination. This cost money. It is said among merchant mariners that, yes, a captain has the authority to refuse orders he deems to be unsafe, but probably only once. Davidson went off on vacation, and when he returned, was informed by Crowley that he no longer had a job. He signed on with Tote as a lowly third mate and had to work his way to the top again. Eventually, he was given the San Juan Run and El Faro to command. Had Davidson been affected by the punishment he had received? Safety was still first for him, but he may no longer have been the secure man he once was. Another issue lurked in the background. El Faro and its sister ship, El Yunque, were soon to be sent to Alaska and replaced on the San Juan Run by two new state-of-the-art vessels. Earlier in the year, Davidson had sought a position as captain of the first of them, but had come up short. Having earned the highest marks on his latest annual performance review, he was holding out hope that he might yet command the second new ship. He was carefully courteous to the Tote office personnel, including John Lawrence, whom he called before he pushed the distress button, as he was about to drown. In Jacksonville, the loading for the final run started at 1 p.m. on Monday, September 28th, and continued on Tuesday until shortly after sundown. The weather was balmy, with light winds and mostly overcast skies. Far out in the Atlantic, a tropical depression had been defying forecast for several days, intensifying rather than simmering down and stubbornly progressing toward the Bahamas on an unusual southwesterly heading rather than turning around and hooking harmlessly back to the northeast, as the meteorological models kept expecting it to do. A day before El Faro's departure, the tropical depression had become a tropical storm named Joaquin. Davidson had been monitoring the forecast and knew of the difficulty the forecasters were having. He had two routes available to him. The first was a straight shot that would take him past the Bahamas, through the open ocean for 2.5 days, and 1,265 miles on an unwavering southeast heading of 130 degrees, directly to San Juan. That was the normal way to go. The question was the hurricane. The second route ran south through the Florida Straits, then east along Cuba through a sinewy narrows called the Old Bahama Channel. This route would have placed a string of wave-breaking islands between the ship and the storm. The problem was that it added 184 miles and more than 6 hours to the trip. The schedule would be thrown out of whack. Davidson opted for the straight shot. El Faro was a fast ship. Superficially rusty, but solid and powerful, the equivalent of a 1970s muscle car, and the timing of the forecast indicated that he could slip past the Bahamas before Joaquin moved in. El Faro cast off at 8:07 on Tuesday evening. 6 hours later, Joaquin became a Category 1 hurricane, with sustained winds greater than 74 miles per hour. The eye lay 245 miles east-northeast of San Salvador, the outermost island of the Bahamian chain, and was slowly moving in that direction. Think of the storm as the right-hand stroke of a V, heading toward the point at the bottom. El Faro, the left-hand stroke of the V, was 550 miles to the northwest, and also heading toward the point, though Davidson believed they would pass the bottom point well before the storm arrived. 4. A good little plan. That was the situation at 5:57 a.m. on Wednesday, September 30th, the morning after departure, when the voice recorder first opens on the bridge. The chief mate, Stephen Schultz, 54, was standing watch. Davidson was conferring with him at the chart table. An unlicensed seaman, Frank Ham III, 49, was at the helm, monitoring the autopilot. He was the hand who always served with Schultz when Schultz was on watch. The ship was rolling in swells approaching from the left. Schultz said, "Got the swell," and Davidson answered, "Oh yeah, probably going to get worse." They were discussing satellite images that showed Joaquin solidifying and growing. Davidson said, "Look, remember how we saw this one the other day festering, and we talked about these are the worst? Hard to predict. Look at the total transformation." Schultz mentioned the possibility of heading farther out to sea, passing over the north side of Joaquin, and Davidson pointed out that the storm was expected to reverse course and move north. That takes your option out to top it. Schultz suggested an alternative, widening slightly to the right to move south of the direct track line to San Juan, giving the storm a bit more space. He even mentioned the Old Bahama Channel, but then he said, "I would wait, get more information." For the initial 24 hours out of Jacksonville, El Faro had television reception and therefore access to the Weather Channel. Broadcasters were closely covering Joaquin, but with emphasis on its potential landfall in 3 or 4 days on the Atlantic seaboard. For marine weather, the ship's crew had multiple options, but used primarily two. The first was an Inmarsat C satellite receiver that automatically fed National Hurricane Center reports to a printer on the bridge nearly as soon as they were disseminated. These so-called SAT-C reports arrived in text form and required the plotting of Joaquin's forecasted positions on a chart, whether paper or electronic. In the case of this storm, the forecasted positions were known to be unreliable, not because of human incompetence, but because the Hurricane Center's mathematical predictive tools were having an unusually difficult time getting a handle on Joaquin. The resulting uncertainty was expressed emphatically in the forecast, and Davidson was aware of it. The second source for weather information was even more problematic. It was a subscription service called the Bon Voyage System, BVS, that processed global weather data to produce its own forecast, primarily in the form of colorful weather maps, which could be animated and over which a ship's course could be laid. By the time the data was processed, it was up to 6 hours old, which in the context of Joaquin was obsolete. Storm Geo, the proprietor of BVS, said during the NTSB investigation that weather routing bulletins were sent to the ship, but not routing guidance, which was not ordered as part of the service contract. The Coast Guard report also noted that El Faro crew did not take advantage of BVS's tropical update feature, which would have provided hourly updates. The BVS map included a timestamp that showed when the processing had been completed, but gave no indication of the age of the raw data on which the forecast was based. Davidson knew that all the forecasts were uncertain and that they sometimes disagreed, but how aware was he that when he looked at the BVS maps, he was looking into the past? He went down to his stateroom after his conversation with Schultz, and when he returned to the bridge, he said, "All right, I just sent up the latest weather. Let us clear everything off the chart table with the exception of the charts." Schultz opened the BVS program. As it happened, according to the NTSB report, because of a software glitch, the map that appeared was the very same map that had come in with the previous download 6 hours earlier. The raw data on which it was based was at least 12 hours old. Davidson and Schultz decided that the storm would be a little too close for comfort when the time came to cross its bow. Working with a GPS-based plotter, they made a slight right turn with a new heading of 140 degrees, creating a gentle dogleg that would pass 10 miles outside San Salvador Island and put them 50 miles from the hurricane's eye. The winds were forecast to be only 40 knots. Davidson said, "I think that's a good little plan, Chief Mate. At least I think we got a little distance from the center." It was 6:40 in the morning, and the sun was coming up. Davidson yawned. He said, "Oh, look at that red sky over there. Red in the morning. Sailors take warning. That is bright." Davidson instructed Schultz to make sure that the crew checked the security and lashings on the cargo and left the bridge for a while. A fresh helmsman and the third mate showed up to relieve Ham and Schultz and stand the next four-hour watch. The third mate was Jeremy Ream. He was 46, but looked younger. Schultz briefed him on the weather and the diversion. He explained that the options were limited, but that if worse came to worst, they could turn behind the outer islands and escape through one of several deep water gaps to reach the old Bahama Channel. After Schultz left the bridge, Ream continued to study the weather. He said to the helmsman, "We're going to get slammed tonight." The view from the bridge was of an endless ocean with no land in sight. Stacked high with containers, the massive ship rolled with a slow rhythm through swells coming in from the east. The sky was mostly clear. The wind was warm and slowly increasing. Davidson returned to the bridge. He engaged in some light-hearted banter, but his mind was on the storm. He said, "I mean, when we went through Erica this last, that's the first real storm I've been on with this ship. Ship's solid. Ream said, the ship is solid. It's just all the associated bits and pieces. The hull itself is fine. The plant, no problem. It's all the shit that shakes and breaks loose. Davidson said, just gotta keep the speed up, so we get going down, and who knows, maybe this low will just stall. Stall, a little bit, just a little bit, just enough for us to duck underneath. But the opposite happened. At 10:35 a.m., a SAT-C report arrived, and Ream took it to the chart table to plot positions. The helmsman said, it's moving away fast. Ream didn't understand that he was joking. He answered, no, it's not moving away, not yet. I'll show you that whole time step forecast if you want. I mean, we're going that way, and it's going to go that way, and we're on a collision course with it, nearly. In other words, that earlier turn was not going to provide the expected margin. It is not known what, if anything, Ream did with the information. 5. Category 3. Shortly before noon, the second mate, Danielle Randolph, arrived with a relief helmsman to stand the next watch. The helmsman was Larry Davis, 63. Randolph was from Rockland, Maine, and like Davidson and three others aboard, was a graduate of the Maine Maritime Academy. She was 34. Ream briefed her on the navigation plan. Speaking of the captain, she said, he's telling everyone down there, oh, it's not a bad storm, it's not so bad. It's not even that windy out. Seen worse. Now alone on the bridge with Davis, Randolph returned to the subject of Davidson. She mimicked him. It's nothing, it's nothing. She backed off the mockery and said, if it's nothing, then why the hell are we going on a different track line? Think he's just trying to play it down because he realizes we shouldn't have come this way? Saving face. Davis said, we're getting sea swells now. The swells slowed the ship. Davidson was in his stateroom. He had paperwork to do, a mandatory noon report to the tote office. He gave an ETA for San Juan of 8 a.m. on Friday, 44 hours ahead. Then he came to the bridge and said, damn, we're getting killed with the speed. Randolph answered him a little rebelliously, oh, yeah, I think now it's not a matter of speed. It's when we get there, as long as we arrive in one piece. Davidson was not so willing to sacrifice the schedule. He said, yeah, well, we're only doing 18.9 right now. I mean, we'll pick up a little bit. Gotta get through this storm. Taking Randolph's lead, Davis said, yeah, through it. A gulf seemed to be opening between Davidson and the crew on the bridge. He may not have noticed it. After he left, a man named Jeffrey Mathias showed up on the bridge. Mathias, 42, was one of El Faro's chief engineers, but on this trip was serving as a supernumerary to oversee five Polish shipyard workers who had been aboard for weeks and were modifying the ship for Alaska service. When Randolph saw him, she said hi with a rising inflection. He said, look at you, all freshened up, huh? She offered him a gourmet coffee from freshly ground beans, and he said, wow. She laughed. She said, we do not joke around here when it comes to coffee. I guess not, damn. Did you want to see the storm? Did you want to see the pretty pictures with the pretty, pretty colors? Meanwhile, Davidson was back in his stateroom, writing another email to the home office. It was addressed to John Lawrence, the designated person ashore, and CC'd to several other managers. The first part of the email was advisory in nature. It reported the deviation underway, described the plan for moving south of the hurricane, and delivered a revised ETA for San Juan. This was exactly what Toad expected. But then the email went further. Concerned about Joaquin's forecasted position over the coming weekend, Davidson wrote, Question. I would like to transmit the old Bahama channel on our return northbound leg to Jacksonville, Florida. This route adds an additional 160 NM to the route for a total of 1,261 NM. We will need to make around 21 knots for our scheduled 10:05, 10:45 arrival time at Jacksonville Pilot Station. This precaution will take the uncertainty out of Joaquin's forecasted track, and as you can see, she really develops into a formidable weather pattern on 10/3/2015. I'm confident that Joaquin will track in a northerly direction once reaching the Gulf Stream current. I will await your reply before transiting Old Bahama Channel on our return leg to Jacksonville, Florida. Should you have any questions or concerns, kindly contact this vessel. Best regards. This email emerged during the investigation after the sinking. At the time, Tote was busy blaming Davidson by insisting that all routing and weather decisions were his alone to make. But here, Davidson appeared to be asking permission for the Old Bahama Channel run. To make matters worse, it was answered by one of the CC'd managers, the director of ship management, Jim Fisker Anderson, who was in San Francisco at the time. Fisker Anderson wrote, Captain Mike, diversion request heads up through Old Bahama Channel, understood and authorized. Thank you for the heads up. Kind regards. Authorized? Was that what went on at Tote? At the very least, the use of that word indicated a superior attitude by an armchair mariner toward a captain tangling with a hurricane at sea. Worse, it raised the possibility that Davidson had taken the straight-line course for San Juan because he had been ordered to do so. Tote officials denied this vehemently. Fisker Anderson told investigators that he wished he had used another word. The use of this one certainly added fuel to the wrongful death litigation that ensued. All 33 wrongful death cases have since been settled at significant expense to the company. But no evidence emerged in the investigations of direct interference in navigational decisions by any managers at Tote. Davidson's wife, Teresa, told the NTSB that her husband would have refused unsafe orders, whatever the consequences. When Davidson finished sending the email, he returned to the bridge and instructed Randolph to start keeping hourly logs of the weather. Wind direction and force, barometer. The wind would have to be estimated because of the faulty anemometer. Both Davidson and Randolph apparently believed they would be dealing with a Category 1 hurricane and at some distance from the eye. Neither they nor the National Hurricane Center suspected that the storm would increase to a Category 3 and accelerate that very night. The wind was increasing, the sea was covered with white caps, and the swells from the east were rising. Davis said, knew it was going to start, sooner or later. Around 4 p.m., the sky started clouding over. Schultz, the chief mate, and Ham, his helmsman, came onto the bridge to take the next watch. Randolph briefed Schultz, then went down to her cabin to write a note to her mother. It was later sent along with a batch of others via the ship's official email. At 4:46 p.m., Randolph and Davis returned to allow Schultz and Ham to go to dinner. The SAT-C printer delivered the latest weather, and Randolph took it to the chart table and began to plot it out. This was information from the National Hurricane Center only a few minutes old, and although it continued to contain forecasting errors, it got the current location of the eye about right. She said, "So at 2 in the morning, Davis said, "What?" "It should be right here." She indicated a position just outside of San Salvador Island. "Let's see where we will be." She did some calculations and began to chuckle. "We're going to be right there with it. Looks like the storm is coming right for us." She laughed in disbelief. "Ah, you gotta be kidding me." Davis said, "We're going to get our ass ripped." Randolph was a Mainer. "Salt of the earth," she said. "We're going to go right through the effing eye." 6. Staying the course. Schultz and Ham returned from dinner. Randolph and Davis left. Davidson showed up around sundown. The sky was heavy with clouds. To Schultz, he said, "I just sent you the latest weather." It was the BVS product depicting a forecast based on old data with additional errors cranked in due to forecasting models. It was not exactly a fiction, but it was a poor tool for attempting a close pass across the bow of a hurricane. They decided to turn the ship 10 degrees to the right, widening away from the storm for a second time. The new course would take Alfaro to a point in the yellow outer fringes on the BVS graphic, clear of the eye and the inner pink. It would also take them to the leeward or west side of San Salvador Island, which for a while would offer some measure of protection from the hurricane's waves. Having plotted the new course directly on the BVS, they made the turn at 7:03 p.m. With its engine running at maximum speed, El Faro was riding comfortably through large swells coming in from the northeast. Davidson was pleased. For the next 45 minutes, he and Schultz calculated GPS waypoints and courses and laid out a tidy plan for the rest of the trip, including a strong left turn in the open waters beyond San Salvador Island and a straight shot across the bow of the hurricane directly for San Juan. They were not entirely complacent. Schultz mentioned the availability of a southerly escape route through a deep water passage by Crooked Island, and Davidson suggested the alternative of sheltering behind San Salvador if need be. But neither man made a plan for such contingencies. Third Mate Jeremy Ream appeared on the bridge for his 8 p.m. to midnight watch. He was joined by his helmsman. Schultz indicated the BVS and said, "See the weather? We have the latest." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.